Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warriors Radio Network.
Not sure if John McCain liked Van Morrison. Welcome back. On a Monday, we remember... I screwed his rank up. Captain John McCain. Real quick about his career. After he returned from Vietnam, in 1973... He became a student at the National War College, then was sent to Florida, where he gained his flight status back, got sent to Florida, and after he did that, he was appointed the Navy liaison to the U.S. Senate. So worked in the Navy's Office of Legislative Affairs, and in a bit of controversy. He divorces his wife that he had married prior to going to Vietnam, and she's a little bit of a history associated with her. Her name's Carol. Supposedly, his capture was difficult on her, as it would be on any spouse. She led a national effort to free him as a POW. Her movement invented the POW. Black flag and the bracelets that prisoners' names on them. So if you remember them from the Vietnam War, you saw people walking around and they had those stainless steel bracelets on, and we all know the flag. A year before he was freed, she was injured in a car accident and walked with a shortened leg. He comes back. And he meets Cindy Lou Hensley, who's a wealthy daughter of a beer distributor, very, very wealthy daughter of a beer distributor. In April 1997, he then divorces his first wife and marries his second wife. So he's working for the Navy on Capitol Hill in 1980. He's promoted to the rank of captain, and he retires from the Navy in 1981. So so they're kind of a general view of his life. Some things to know about him. His grandparents are from Arkansas, Mississippi, and Texas, and much of his ancestry is from the South. He traces his parental side through Mississippi. The McCain plantation had slaves before the American Civil War, and they are described and still share the McCain surname, and are called Black McCains. They became sharecroppers after. And it also has a long history, the McCain family, of service. He traced his family back to soldiers who fought in the American Revolution, the Indian Wars, the War of 1812. They fought on the Confederate side during the American Civil War. McCain's father and his father's father became Navy admirals. And so you can see growing up, if you can imagine growing up in that environment, you know, and you'll hear him say this, he saw that he'd live a life where service, military service, was a big part of it. His grandfather, John S., nicknamed Slew McCain Sr., who died in 1945, was a pioneer of aircraft carrier operations, who in 1942 commanded all land-based air operations in support of the Guadalcanal campaign. And ultimately, in the 1945 time frame, led the Fast Carrier Task Force in the Pacific Ocean. His operations off the coast of the Philippines and Okinawa and airstrikes against Formosa and the Japanese homelands obviously caused great destruction. He died 4 days after the Japanese surrender in Tokyo Bay, which was front page news. His son, right, McCain's father, named Jack McCain, was a submarine commander in several theaters of operations in World War II and was decorated with the Silver Star and the Bronze Star Medal. So, comes from quite incredible lineage in terms of a military guy. You know, it sounds very reminiscent of the Douglas MacArthur family, steeped in military history. This is an interview, again, with the Oral History Project that interviews veterans of all walks of life. So John McCain. Right here. So here you have it. And again, you know, you hear a lot of people talking about John McCain. When to me the best way to understand somebody, listen to their own words. Here is John McCain.
My name is Michelle Kelly, and I'm the director of oral history for the Battleship Massachusetts, and we are an official partner of the Veterans Oral History Project at the Library of Congress. I'd like to start by asking you a few questions about your background. Could you state your full name and title?
John Sidney McCain, United States Senator from Arizona.
And when were you born?
August 29th, 1936, in Cocosola, Panama.
Being that your father and grandfather were both four-star admirals, did you always feel that you were bound for life in the Navy?
I believe so. I resisted it from time to time, but I was pretty sure that was what was going to happen.
Where were you when President Kennedy was assassinated, and what were your thoughts?
I was at Virginia Beach, Virginia, in a house that three other bachelors and I were living in, and I happened to be at home. And I was watching television and, of course, heard the news. And I think my emotions were very similar to the majority of Americans: shock, sorrow, anger. But mostly shock.
What lessons did Annapolis teach you about character and integrity that have stayed with you?
I think that over time, a school like the Naval Academy instills in you certain principles, adherence to a certain code of honor, dependence on your comrades, the class system, where you're loyal to your classmates, and then, of course, a reverence for and a desire to emulate leaders that you're taught about, while they're John Paul Jones, Bull Halsey, Teddy Roosevelt, those kinds of people. I think over the four-year period, it's sort of ingrained in you.
What made you choose to be a Navy pilot?
I thought it was the most glamorous and exciting life that any person could ever choose. That was always my goal. And my grandfather had been an aviator as well.
Before you actually went to Vietnam, what did you know about the war through the media and through the military?
I didn't know a lot. I read about the various conflicts and the battles that had taken place, and I was aware of the gradual escalation. But like most Americans, I had never heard of the 1954 agreements in Geneva that divided North and South Vietnam. I didn't have any knowledge of the background and history of the Vietnamese people. I believe that it was the classic struggle between communism and
freedom. Referring to the time before you were taken prisoner, how did the actual experience of being in Vietnam differ from what you had imagined it would be?
my views about the conflict were not affected in any way that I can remember, but the futility of the way we were carrying on the air war became more and more apparent. We'd watch the Russian freighters pull into Haiphong Harbor, unload the SAM missiles, and truck them up and put them in place. We couldn't touch them, and then they'd be fired at us. That kind of war, targets picked by Lyndon Johnson in the basement of the White House. I remember one target I had one day was a place that had been bombed numerous times before, and 100 yards away was a bridge. Couldn't strike the bridge, but could make the concrete bounce at the target that I was assigned. It was foolish, and all of us who were flying there knew it was foolish, and it was worse than that in many respects because so many of my squadron mates and air wing mates were shot down and killed and captured.
It's their video, okay, that has the gaps in it. So it's not you, it's not me, it's them.
What was a typical day like at Yankee Station?
There was period.
Yankee Station is not in the Bronx. That's Yankee Stadium. Yankee Station was off the coast of Vietnam.
It's on Yankee Station where we had just sort of routine launches every hour and 40 minutes where you'd get probably a couple of sorties a day where you'd go out in two or four airplanes on various specific targets. The other was when we were in the kinds of operations we called alpha strikes, and that would be once a day and maximum of twice a day where practically all the air wing would be launched. At one time, we'd rendezvous and then go and strike a major target, usually up around Hanoi or the Haiphong area. On the day I was shot down, for example, it was the thermal power plant in Hanoi that we were striking, which was in downtown Hanoi. Those kind of strikes required very large numbers of airplanes, sometimes even joining up with the air wings from other aircraft carriers that were on station as well.
Can you tell me about the fire aboard the Forrestal?
We were preparing for an alpha strike, and there was a large number of airplanes, and I was in mine, had started the engine, was going through the engine checks. Across the flight deck from me was an F-4 Phantom, and on the Phantom wings were Zuni rockets, which are long, 6-foot-long rockets. And the procedure that's required on board safety procedures is that there's what we call a pigtail, which is electrical connection that goes to the rear end of the rocket. And the way the rocket is fired is an electrical impulse fires goes through that and fires the rocket. Well, that pigtail, as it's called, is not supposed to be inserted until the airplane is on the catapult facing the water. Those rules were violated, unfortunately, that day, and the pigtail was inserted in the Zuni rocket, and as the pilot went from external power, which is what's used to start the engine of the airplane, much like a commercial airliner, to internal power, which means that you use the power from the you're not dependent on the outside source of electricity anymore. A very large charge of stray electricity went to the pigtail and fired the Zuni rocket across the flight deck, punched through the fuel tank, the 200-gallon fuel tank that was underneath my A4 Skyhawk, and continued on. The fuel spilled out naturally, and the fuel was on fire. And in a very short period of time, there was a huge conflagration on the Forrestal, which ended up taking the lives of 135 young sailors, and took about 12 to 18 hours, depending on how you look at it, to put the fire out. I shut down the engine of my air, felt the shock of it, saw the fire, jumped out, of, you know, by going out on the refueling probe, and all this is on film, by the way, because it was we had constant filming of the flight deck, and rolled through the fire and went across the other side of the flight deck, saw people running around, saw a number of things, including people with a fire hose, and I saw the pilot plane next to mine jump out of his airplane, only he didn't jump as far, and when he rolled out, he was on fire, and I started towards him just as I did. The first bomb blew off and knocked me back, and then other bombs started going off, and that's when the conflagration started. I would say there was couldn't have been more than about 2 minutes between the time that my airplane was hit by the Zuni rocket until the time that the first bomb went off, which then complicated the disaster dramatically, of course.
Between that incident and the two plane crashes that you're in, did you ever feel superstitious?
Oh, I'm always superstitious. I'm very superstitious, yes.
And then going on the Oriskany, because didn't that have a history of...
The Oriskany had the highest losses of any air wing in the Vietnam conflict, yeah.
Did you do things to, being superstitious, did you do things for good luck?
Yeah, and I'm sorry, because I always had this, on the forest all, there was a young, what we call parachute rigger, the guy in the squadron that takes care of the pilot's equipment. And I always kind of had this view that my visor needed to be clean. And so after my plane was started and after I was ready to go, I would always hand my helmet down to him, and he would clean the visor off and give it back to me and put it on. And I had just gotten the helmet back from him after he cleaned the visor and put it on. And when the rocket hit, and unfortunately we never saw him again, unfortunately. But I still am one who tries to avoid stepping on a crack and will pick up a penny if the head's up and all of those things.
Can you describe the circumstances under which you were taken prisoner by the Vietnamese?
Well, we were striking the Hanoi thermal power plant. It was a very large airstrike. We came in. There was heavy and concentrated both anti-aircraft fire and surface-to-air missiles were everywhere. At that time, Hanoi was the most heavily defended place in history. And as I rolled into to bomb the target, I rolled in and sighted on the thermal power plant, which sat on the end of a lake called Chupak Lake, the Western Lake. And just as I released the bombs and started to pull back on the stick, a surface air missile hit and took the right wing off my airplane. My airplane violently gyrated. I ejected as the airplane was going down. They're striking my knee on the canopy when I went out and broke my arm as well, both my arms, and parachuted into a lake called the Western Lake. I had some difficulty getting my life vest to inflate. I had to use my teeth to pull the toggle on it, and after struggling around, and then when I floated the surface, some Vietnamese came out and pulled me into shore. The crowd was rather angry, which is understandable, and they hit me and broke my shoulder with a rifle butt and bayoneted me a couple of times. And then army guys came and took pictures of some woman giving me a cup of tea and threw me into the truck and took me to the Hoa Lo prison, which we know of as a Hanoi Hilton, an old French prison built by the French prison in downtown Hanoi.
Can you tell me about living conditions at the Hanoi Hilton and how they changed after you refused early release?
Conditions were very poor in the first few years. years. Guards were very tough. Food was poor. A lot of dysentery. I lived in most of the time in solitary confinement, although I was always in contact by tapping with other prisoners. I was never beaten very badly up until the time I refused the early release, but after that it was very severe for about 8 or 9 months. But they attempted to get a war crimes confession out of me. But after a while I'd eased off some, and then after about middle to late 1970, after Ho Chi Minh had died, our treatment changed for everybody and it improved rather dramatically.
What kind of food did they give you?
Soup twice a day, piece of bread usually, and soup was four months a year it was a pumpkin soup, 4 months a year it was cabbage soup, and 4 months a year it was a greens kind of a thing that looked like clipped grass. Sometimes there would be some meat in it, sometimes not. That was basically our food. As I say, with the change in treatment, the food improved significantly, though.
Can you tell me why you refused early release?
Well, I was not in good shape. I knew that the Vietnamese thought I was an important prisoner because of my father being an admiral and commander of U.S. forces in the Pacific. It wasn't an easy decision because I was in very poor physical health. But I also knew the code of conduct said sick and injured go first and then by order of capture. Everett Alvarez had been there 3 years before I ever got there. Unfortunately, I did not have much communication except with the guy in the cell next to me, so I had no contact with the senior ranking officer. But I made the decision that it was better for me to go home in order. I'm very happy I didn't know I was going to be there for another 3 years.
Did that have to do with a code of honor?
Well, the code of conduct, which was a result of the Korean War, which was our first experience with the, quote, brainwashing. 37 Americans after the Korean War chose to live in China and not come back to the United States. The code of conduct was developed, and it says very clearly, I will not accept parole. I will go home in order of capture, except for those who are sick and injured. So it was very clear in the code of conduct. The question was, how sick and injured was I? And that was a bit of a question to say. Wisest decision that I ever made.
You referred to many POWs by name in your book. How many of these men did you actually have the opportunity to communicate with directly while in prison?
Well, during the first few years, very few. Only those around, the cells around me, because we were kept either in solitary confinement or two to a cell. Later on, when we were put in large rooms of 25 to 30 POWs in each, I got to know very well maybe about 40 or 50 POWs.
In the Faith of My Fathers, you referred to being interviewed by a Cuban doctor, Fernando Barral. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but posing as a psychiatrist and the presence of Cuban torturers in the Hanoi Hilton. Did you have any other contact with Cubans in Vietnam?
No. And I didn't, fortunately, have contact with the Cuban interrogators. They were in another camp, but the people who were there said they were extremely brutal.
What kind of relationship did Dr. Barral appear to have with the North Vietnamese?
It's hard for me to tell. Obviously, he was a guest of the North Vietnamese, but, it was one of these things where they took me in a Jeep and blindfolded, and I walked into this room, sat down, talked to the guy for about a 15 minutes or so and left, so.
When I was reading your book, I was surprised at how much humor was used by you and by the other POWs. Can you tell me about the role that humor plays in those situations?
Humor is vital to one's resistance and mental stability. We used to play this program that we called Hanoi Hannah. It was their radio program every morning and every evening, and it was always entertaining and to make fun of the guards rather than be afraid of them. And we called the camp commander Slophead, and we would give different names to different guards. It's very important. Communication is absolutely essential. A sense of humor is very important. If you don't have that, you have a tendency to your captor to become larger and larger and more powerful, and therefore you're more and more intimidated. If you laugh at them, then it puts them back to their actual size.
You said when you first got there, when you weren't...
Pretty interesting point about humor and ridicule. And a lot of times, you know, they would use those, you know, you see prisoners using terms like that, and they're, you know, because their captors don't understand the English language and the subtleties of it, they don't catch on to it until somewhat later, and then somebody gets their ass beat for it. So, very interesting stuff, though, from Senator McCain.
Treated quite as
Captain McCain.
In such extreme violence as some of the other POWs because of your father's position, and so you acted out more? In what ways did you? Or you were more reckless, that's the word you used?
Yeah, because I wasn't punished as badly as others when I would be communicating or talking back to the guards. That was a luxury that I enjoyed until the time I refused to be released.
How much did you know about the progress of the war while you were a prisoner?
We knew more by omission than commission. For example, I remember hearing night after night about how Khe San was going to fall, that the Marines were surrounded, they had no chance. And then one night we didn't hear about Khe San anymore, which clearly indicated to us that it had not fallen. Most of the rest of it was just such blatant propaganda that you just dismissed it. And so it was hard to know what was going on. What we really didn't appreciate, because we blocked out most of the information, was how strong the anti-war movement had become in the United States. That came as a great surprise to us. When I was shot down in 1967, the anti-war movement was, you know, just another irritant. And so it was hard for us to imagine how divisive the war had become in our society until we came out. It was probably my greatest surprise.
How did you first find out about that?
Well, they told us all the stuff, you know, but we didn't believe it. I mean, they would, whatever, anywhere in the world someone burned an American flag, we would hear about it. But we dismissed it as just communist propaganda. It wasn't until we got out and found out that it really was one of the most divisive crises in the history of our country.
What were some of the traits of your fellow prisoners that you admired most?
Courage, ingenuity, humor. I was privileged to observe 1,000 acts of courage and compassion and love. It's a great honor of my life.
Can you tell me about your release from the prison camp and how you adjusted to everyday life back in the United States?
The Vietnamese divided us up into different camps in groups of when we had been shot down, because the releases were first group released with the earliest shot down, Alvarez and company, and second group, third group. I think there were like five groups over a period of about 3 months. And Vietnamese came and gave us shoes. They gave us pants and a shirt. And food, obviously, was really dramatically good. First time we had stuff to read. And one day they took us outside of the camp, and we got onto buses, and the buses went to the airport in Hanoi, and we got off the buses, and there was a table with Vietnamese Americans. They called out your name, and you went forward. American greeted you, and you walked and got on the airplane. We went and spent about 3 days in the Philippines, where we got initial physical exams and that kind of thing, and then flew back to the places that we had been stationed when we'd shot down. In my case, it was Jacksonville, Florida. And it took me about 45 minutes to adjust. I've never had a nightmare. I've never had a flashback. I've never had any difficulties at all. Some physical difficulties, obviously, but it didn't take me any time at all to adjust. The last couple of years, we were together in groups, and we did a lot of things, from history classes and mathematics to putting on plays and skits and movies and playing cards. And so, you know, it wasn't as if I had just walked out of 3 years of solitary confinement into the outside world. So it didn't take most of us long at all.
What experiences prompted you to go into politics?
My last job in the Navy was the Navy liaison officer to the Senate, a small office in the Russell Senate office building. I and a then Marine Major, Jim Jones, who later became the Commandant of the Marine Corps and now is the head of NATO, and I worked there, and I got interested in the political process because I observed it here. I saw how impactful a hard-working, dedicated, knowledgeable member of the Senate can be, so I aspired to be one.
What do you consider to be some of your major successes as a public servant?
Passage of the campaign finance reform law was probably one of the major achievements. But I've been involved in a host of national security issues. As chairman of the Commerce Committee, I've been involved in many of the telecommunications, aviation, transportation issues. As one of the authors of the Transportation Security Act, which, post 9/11. And I think we've tried to take care of our constituents who need help. I'm very proud of that. So, normalization of relations with Vietnam is something that I'm proud of.
You refer to Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls. How do you feel that your life and your public service has gone according to the philosophies extolled in that book?
Well, Robert Jordan, Hemingway's hero in Protagonist and For Whom the Bell Tolls, was a man who was dedicated, selfless, brave, capable, but also stoic. He recognized that the cause he served was a flawed one, but he still served it to the point where he was willing to sacrifice his life, even if not only the cause, but the particular enterprise, the blowing of a bridge, blowing up of a bridge, would have no effect on the conflict. He still went out and did it, and then was willing to sacrifice his very life. And his final words were, "The world is a fine place and worth the fighting for, and I'll hate very much to leave it."
What is your idea of honor, and from your father and from your grandfather?
My idea of honor is to serve a cause greater than your self-interest. And there's lots of good causes, and you can serve them in many ways. You don't have to serve them in the Spanish Civil War, as Robert Jordan did. You can serve them in your own community and even in your own home.
You told the story of your father's presence at Operation Torch during World War II and on the submarine gunwale. Did he ever mention seeing the USS Massachusetts, which is also there?
You know, I think you don't remember.
Is there anything else that we should talk about?
No, except to say that I've been very fortunate in my life. I'm probably the luckiest person that you will ever interview. I survived many near-death experiences. I've had the privilege of serving the country now for 22 years in the Navy, and now nearly 22 years in the Congress of the United States. And I've had opportunities to see and be involved in some important moments in the history of our country, and played a very, very small role in our country's great story. And so I think that I'm really the most fortunate person that I've ever known or heard of, and truly blessed.
I do have one more question for you, and that is, what do you think about our current involvement in the possibility of going to war with Iraq?
I think it's very likely that we will be in a conflict. I think it'll be brief. I think we will win with a minimum of casualties, although any casualty is a tragedy. And I think we have the opportunity to put a democratic form of government in Iraq and end a very brutal, oppressive regime on the Iraq people of Iraq. So I regret that we have to do this because we will lose American lives. But at the same time, I think there's a possibility of doing great and wonderful things.
Well, thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
John McCain, in his own words, I'll tell you what, there's stuff that I certainly didn't know, and that's why I say it's always interesting to listen to these kind of interviews. All right, I'm trying to be disciplined, all right? So, him narrating the events on the forestall, pretty interesting in that interview. His talking about his own imprisonment and how little time it took him to adapt to come home. You know, one of the things that I think it's interesting when you're trying to get your hand around the 2% figure in terms of PTSD relative to veterans of the Hanoi Hilton. When the North Vietnamese knew the war was drawing down to a close, and they knew those prisoners would be at some point returned to the United States, as Senator McCain said, as Captain McCain said, they changed their treatment dramatically. The kind of men they were, and some of them were exceptional men. Together, talking to each other, their sense of purpose and things like that, all come through in a way that I don't know that we can appreciate. And to me, I'm going to begin to do shows on it, because that period of time, and I think it's a form of therapy, right? That you're together with other men like you that have gone through your experience. And you're not, there is no pity party, there is no woe is me. Right? They're men with purpose, and they find greater purpose in life. So I think it's very interesting, very interesting. All right, here's Senator McCain. That was done in 2003. So 14 years later, in the meantime, Senator McCain has been the Republican nominee for president. I will say this: I listened to his speech as he accepts the Republican nomination on a historical night for him. It's not a very good speech. I mean, it kind of sucks as a speech, to be honest with you. And so, but his last speech, and we'll probably talk about his political life tomorrow. But today I wanted to devote to his military career. So this is John McCain reflecting on the Vietnam War 50 years later with I believe it's Brian Lamb.
Two of the more than 5 years he was held as a POW were spent in solitary confinement. Marking this anniversary, the senator talked with American History TV about those events, and he reflected on the war's legacy and impact on America.
Senator McCain, when you look back 50 years ago when your plane went down there in Hanoi, and through the last 50 years, what today, in your opinion...
Now, again, this is in 2017. Keep that in mind. John McCain, 14 years less than a year ago.
And are the legacies of Vietnam, good and bad?
The legacies of Vietnam is that we, before we get into a conflict, we'd better have a strategy and a capability to win. And this is one of these gradual drip, drip, drip involvements. Started out with a thing called the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, where there was supposedly, and it's still not clear to this day, confrontation between Vietnamese ships and American ships, which then led to a resolution ran through by Lyndon Johnson to a complete lack of focus and strategy on how to bring it to a close. And I'm very sympathetic, because the one thing that overrode most of Lyndon Johnson's thinking, appropriately, was China. That we certainly didn't want to have a confrontation and a conflagration that would lead to a real conflict there. So it cautioned all of our actions, so that it was a very gradual escalation, which then not only didn't harm the enemy, but it strengthened their resolve. And that led, of course, to all kinds of implications and repercussions. The New Age, the use of drugs, demonstrations. Right out here on this mall, there was a million people, or however many it was, that... It really split our society in a way that that we sometimes forget. Mass arrests, demonstrations, Chicago, that all of us can look back and see on C-SPAN. But it was a tumultuous time, and most of it was bred by the conflict. And one aspect of the conflict, by the way, that I will never, ever countenance, is that we drafted the lowest income level of America, and the highest income level found a doctor that would say that they had a bone spur. That is wrong. That is wrong. If we're going to ask every American to serve, every American should serve. And later in the war, we went to the lottery system, which was, but for years and years, it was the lowest income Americans, which means a lot of minorities, that were forced to go and fight. And that's a black mark on the history of this country, asking those with the lowest income level to do the fighting for us while the wealthiest stayed home.
When you were in your, I believe, A4,
yep,
taking off from Forrestal, the carrier,
yep,
how apprehensive were you when you were flying into a place like northern Vietnam that you get shot down?
Well, I was on board the USS Forrestal, where we had a horrific fire, and I was hit by a missile and all that. My plane was on the flight deck. And then I transferred over to the USS Oriskany. I was flying off the Oriskany
for that, yeah.
when I was shot down. What was I thinking? I was a young fighter pilot.
How old were you?
28, something like that. Listen, that's what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to go to combat. I wanted to go against the enemy. And it wasn't so much that they were the enemy as that, you know, that's what I was trained to do all those years. And I wanted to do it. It wasn't as if I was, oh, no, I don't want to have to fly this combat mission. It was that I'm ready to go. And my contemporaries and my squadron mates were the same way. And we took a lot of losses. But one of the great things about being a fighter pilot is you're sure that everybody else is going to get shot down, but not you.
And when that happened, how many Vietnamese were around you in the water in that lake?
Well, when I first went in, it's a long story, but I was barely able to get back to the surface. But then a bunch of them jumped in, and there's a picture, which I'm sure you'll show, of them pulling me out of the lake. You can see my arm is broken and up high. And then, of course, once they pulled me out, they weren't very happy to see me.
Why not?
Because I just finished bombing the place. And so that we got pretty rough. Broke my shoulder and hurt my knee again. But look, I don't blame them. I don't blame them. We're in a war. I didn't like it. But at the same time, when you're in a war and you're captured by the enemy, you can't expect, to have tea. And so they pulled me out of the, long story short, pulled me out of the lake, put me in a truck, beat me up a little and then went to the now famous Hanoi Hilton prison, which was just a short drive away, 5-minute drive away. And then it's a very long story about how they found out who my father was, and they decided to give me treatment, and two wonderful Americans they moved me into finally, who thought that they moved me in to die, and they took care of me and nursed me back to health. And then after they saw me in better health, they put me into solitary confinement. And look, I don't hold a grudge against the North Vietnamese. I don't like them. There's some that I would never want to see again. But at the same time, I was part of a conflict, okay? And I thought they were some of the meanest people I've ever met in my life, and I never want to see again. But there were several that were good people and that were kind to me. So that's why it was much easier for me to support, along with President Clinton and others, the normalization of relations with our two countries to heal the wounds of war.
When you got back from over there, how much did you and your dad talk about it?
A lot, a lot. It was very hard on my dad, particularly since I knew what was happening to me and he didn't. And so everybody that would come through Hawaii in his command would want to talk about me, and they did the right thing. They said, please just don't talk about Admiral McCain's son, because then that takes up the whole conversation. But every Christmas, for 4 years, he would fly all the way up to the DMZ, the dividing line between North and South Vietnam, and have Christmas dinner with the Marines. And then, of course, and remember that these Marines and soldiers, they were draftees. They weren't there because they volunteered. And they're mainly 18, 19-year-old kids. It's just, I've seen those pictures. They're just beautiful. And he would come back very happy and restored from that experience. And so he was very cognizant of the fact that the North Vietnamese were valued my presence. And as you know, there's so many stories we could tell, but they offered me a chance to be released. But our code of conduct says sick and injured and by order of capture. And I knew why they were offering me release. If my name had been Smith, it wouldn't have. And so, but saying no was it wasn't the easiest thing to say. And I don't mean to bounce around, but 3 years afterwards, after I had refused, on Christmas Eve, cold Christmas Eve in Hanoi, I was in solitary confinement. Every cell had a loudspeaker in it, and they were playing Christmas music. I still remember that one of the songs was I'll Be Home for Christmas, sung by Dinah Shore. That was a bit nostalgic, but anyway, that the same guy who was the leader of all the camps came into my cell. And to make a very long story short, he told me about an island that Ho Chi Minh used to love to go to, which many years later I demanded a visit to and went to. But most importantly, at the end of the evening, it was purely social. That's the only time it's ever done. And he was giving me cigarettes, and he was telling me about it, like Ho Chi Minh's Island and how his father had been part of the Viet Minh and all that. But anyway, make a long story short, he said, you know, there's an island that Ho Chi Minh uses to rest, relax, refresh, and it's out in the Tonkin Gulf. And he said, my father was going out there with Ho Chi Minh, but nobody knows about it. I said, really? Years later, normalization of relations, the foreign minister of Vietnam comes to Washington. I have him to lunch in the Senate dining room. And he says, whatever you want, we will do, because you're our friend. You know? And I said, okay. I said, I want to go to Ho Chi Minh's Island. He said, how do you know about Ho Chi Minh's Island? No one knows about Ho Chi Minh's Island. I said, I know about Ho Chi Minh Island. So about 6 months later, Mark Salter and I and Cindy go to Haiphong and get on a boat and go out and spend the night looking at the sunset from the balcony of Ho Chi Minh's bedroom. Amazing story.
How big an island was it? Or is it?
Not real big, but not small. In other words, I'd say so that you could probably walk from end to end of it in half hour. You know, it was. So anyway, we spent the night there, and so he came to Washington, and he has since passed away. He was the interpreter for Deng Xiaoping.
Van Dandong?
Yeah. No. For come on. Anyway. When he.
In the Paris or
Paris peace talks. I have a on my wall in my office. There is a cable that was sent by Averill Harriman to back to the State Department, classified secret, and it says on it at the tea break, Lê Duc Tho. That's who it was. Lê Duc Tho was the North Vietnamese negotiator. At the tea break, Lê Duc Tho said that the Vietnamese had intended to release the Admiral McCain's son, but he had refused. And that was part of the documents that we declassified, because for a while there everybody was believing that we'd left Americans behind. So it's such long stories, but Senator Mitchell and Senator Dole set up this select committee headed by me and John Kerry. And part of the deal was that the conspiracy theory people said, there's all these secret documents that are out there that will prove that we left Americans behind. So part of our report is we said that everything has to be declassified that has anything to do with POW/MIAs. Well, one of the documents that came out was the one that I mentioned to you. It was from Averill Harriman in Paris back to the State Department. And that was really remarkable. When it came, thousands of documents came out. And that one was more than interesting.
Let me ask you about, we're going through a period.
Sorry for the long answers.
No, it's fine. Yeah. We're going through a period where we see
really interesting stuff from Senator McCain. Captain McCain. Why do I call him Senator? He's supposed to be Captain today. Anyway, this is John McCain, Brian Lamb, on the occasion of the 50th commemoration of Vietnam. And again, celebrated in 2017, 50 years from what? The Vietnam started from the midpoint, maybe? It started well before 67 and ended well after. So I'm not sure why they chose 1967 as the date. But Bob Nielsen called it Vietnam Valentine's Day. They just picked a date. So Brian Lamb, formerly of C-SPAN, retired now, I believe came out of retirement to do this interview.
See a lot of hate speech?
Yeah.
Now, I want to ask you, this may be sensitive, but I want to ask you, you came out of the Vietnam War and you say, I'm not bitter. I didn't have nightmares. I got over it. Relate that to what our president said about you.
Well,
when he said you are no war hero, what did that feel like? And here's a guy that had, what, 5 deferments and all that. How do you process that?
I think you just ignore it. I really do. I watch what the president does, not what he says. I think the important thing about that statement, though, was not about me. I went out not that long ago after he said that, because occasionally people come to us, their relative served in a war and didn't get the medals that they earned. And we do the research. And anyway, 92-year-old man from Scottsdale, Arizona, a prisoner of war in Germany, weighed 110 pounds when he was finally, when the Germans finally were stopped fighting. And so we gave him his medals, and it was wonderful. At a retirement home, all of them were there. It was very moving. And I was talking to him before it, and he said, Senator McCain, tell me, why is it that Donald Trump doesn't like me? And I said, sir, he does, and so do all Americans. So it wasn't what he said about me, because I'm in the arena, but what he said, like that 92-year-old man who came out of a stalag weighing 110 pounds. That's what I take exception to.
How much of this hate speech we see in the society of the drugs, and you mentioned this earlier, came out of a period in our existence 50 years ago today, when you were shot down, where the government wasn't telling us the truth?
The government wasn't telling us the truth. The whole McNamara apparatus was...
No relation.
They had this idea about, quote, unquote, graduated escalation, that if we just stepped up the bombing a little more, it would drive them to the negotiating table and we would come to a peaceful end. Well, what actually was happening was that it was pumping up the morale of the North Vietnamese because they thought they were beating us. I mean, look, we were able to fight back from the aggressors. And so the whole concept was fatally flawed. And to prove that point was when the talks in Paris had broken down. So finally Richard Nixon said, okay, go in and wipe them out. And we went in with B-52s and other aircraft and just took out all resistance. Guess what? They agreed to negotiate. So the problem, I think, had a lot to do with a belief that somehow you can convince the enemy to compromise when the enemy does not think that they are being beaten. And of course the Tet Offensive, and there's so much we could talk about, but there was so much morale boost, and the Chinese and the Russians were giving them everything they wanted. I mean, still the most heavily defended place in the history of the world was Hanoi with the Russian surface-to-air missiles. And most people aren't going to believe this, but a Russian ship would show up in Haiphong Harbor, be offloaded, the missiles be offloaded onto a vehicle, taken up, put in place, and while we watched it, and then those missiles were fired at American aircraft. It's worse than ridiculous. The first target I had when I was in combat had already been bombed 12 times. It was a rubble. It was a pile of rubble. So I went in and bombed the rubble again. And right not far away from it was a bridge that wasn't on the, quote, approved list. That's not the way to fight a war.
I was watching a tape of a North Vietnamese former head of one of that, maybe the Hoa Lo prison, who said that you weren't tortured.
No, I was treated like a king. The feather bed had some lumps in it that I would like.
What about the difference when he say you weren't tortured? And we've told people that we have not tortured. And I know you've been against the idea. So what is it? Why is it so hard for governments to tell the truth?
Well, I mean, it's a classic communist, I mean, what do you think that they would say? Yes, we beat him up. We broke his arm again. We did.
We don't do it either. We don't tell the truth in that.
No, and that's one of the problems that I have had for a long time now is what our treatment of detainees, particularly in the use of waterboarding, that makes us really, that's one of the more embarrassing chapters, in my view, of American history is the way we treat it. There's a story that KSM, colleague Sheikh Mohammed, was being waterboarded, and they sent a message back to CIA saying, we can't get anything out of him. And the answer was, waterboard him some more. Waterboarding was deemed a war crime, and Japanese officers were shot and executed because they waterboarded people. It is clearly a war crime. And there, by the way, the CIA has gotten away with it. They've destroyed the film, they've destroyed a lot of the information, and it would be a black mark in the history of this country that we did that. And frankly, I'll never forgive the CIA for what they did.
Go back to the comparison on something. We know a lot about your torture.
Yep.
What has been harder for you, living through the torture or living through the cancer?
Well, I think, you know, living through cancer is a challenge that I have. Living through torture is you never know what's going to happen the next morning, whether they're going to come around and open your cell door and say, come on out. So at least with this fight that I'm in, I know the enemy and I know what we have to do and know that we take the consequences. But let me also say, Brian, that we are now talking about 50 years. I am the most fortunate person of all the thousands that you have interviewed that you will ever know. I have had the best and full life that anybody could possibly have. So I look at this challenge as with joy, with happiness, and with gratitude. Gratitude that I have had the opportunity to serve this country a little bit.
Have you noticed any change in the way people are approaching you since you've dealt with this latest?
Yeah, it's been more sympathetic. I'm sure that some of them are glad I'm going. No, I've been greeted with, look, the people have told me that when I gave the speech the other night and 100 senators were in their seats, that's the first time that's ever happened. So there has been an incredible outpouring of friendship. I mean, unbelievable. Moves me to tears.
What is your treatment now?
I received radiation and chemo, and I've had it done twice, and now I'm waiting for an MRI. I want to tell you that nobody expected me to have the energy level, and I don't have any problem sleeping, I don't have any problem eating, I am exercising all the time. I'm in fine shape, and so let's see what happens. I've fooled them before.
One last question about the Vietnam legacy thing.
Yeah.
What was the impact on the Vietnam War on our military up to this time?
The impact on our military of the Vietnam War was a devastating blow, not a fatal blow, but a devastating blow. After the war was over, the Chief of Staff of the United States Army came to the Armed Services Committee and said, Senators, you have a hollow army, because the military was eroded because of drugs, because of anti-war, because of the inequities of the draft. We were in bad shape. And fortunately, then, if I may be a bit parochial, Ronald Reagan came along with the commitment to rebuild our military, and we did. And it's good now. There's a lot of problems right now, but the fact is, it's not the morale issue. Listen, we had Marine company officers that were discharging half their company because they weren't performing. We gave them the authority to just throw them out if they're not any good. And there was a famous Marine general who said, the immediate guy came up to him and said, "Look, you have all these guys, you're throwing out all these guys out of the Marine Corps. What's going to be left?" And he said, "You see that guy over there? He said, he's my driver. If he and I are the only two left in the Marine Corps, if that's what it takes, I'm going to fix the Marine Corps." So it was a very big problem, a challenge to rebuild our military after what happened after the Vietnam conflict.
John McCain, in his own words, we'll take a break. There's a ton to talk about him. Again, John McCain's a punk. He's got a chip on his shoulder. And you see that in his life. You see it at Annapolis. In combat, I think, he's being able to live that life. It's funny to hear him talk about how superstitious he is. In the interview, the Veterans Project, he talks about, he knew that when they went to the Oriskany, and ships have reputations, right? And you hear, from hundreds of years ago, it was a cursed ship, right? Well, there's still that lore that goes with ships. Certain ships are good, certain ships are not. But anyway, I don't believe that, and I believe it's the crew that certainly makes a ship. The machine doesn't have a lot to say about it. But anyway, he talks about how superstitious he is. And the Oriskany had the highest rate of pilots shot down in Vietnam. And so that's kind of interesting. Again, I think his thoughts about post-traumatic stress are very, very interesting. And I also think when you try to get your hands around why the 2%, that come out of the Hanoi Hilton, that again, and we'll do more subject about it, but content about it, but that period of time post when, they were, the North Vietnamese knew that they were going to come home. They got them together. They fed them better. They were allowed to communicate, and the men they had become was certainly not the man that they had showed up as. And their community together, saying mass together, them doing plays and having historical discussions. One of the things you hear about in the POW experience is how important the ability to memorize is. And McCain evidently had an incredible memory. So anyway, we'll take a break. Interesting stuff. Gunnar going to join us next. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio on a Monday that we remember Captain John Sidney McCain, United States Navy, retired, who lost his fight with brain cancer, I believe, on Saturday. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.